From the Moan Broadcast Center, it's Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Libby Denkman, sitting in for Larry Mantle. The Senate is trying to end the budget impasse that's kept the government shut down for over a month. We'll take a look at the offers on the table and next steps for the White House and Congress. Plus, we have a new boss here at KPCC. Herb Scannell has been named president and CEO. He'll be live with me in studio coming up in a few minutes.
KPCC podcasts are supported by Pepperdine's Graduate School of Education and Psychology, offering an evening master's in clinical psychology program with an MFT. Priority deadline to apply is February 18th at gsep.pepperdine.edu.
You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Libby Denkman in for Larry Mantle while he takes the day off. It is day 34 of the partial federal government shutdown, and that means close to 800,000 federal employees are on the verge of a second missed paycheck. There are dueling bills coming up for a vote in the Senate today, but don't get those hopes up just yet. Neither funding measure is expected to pass the 60-vote threshold needed to overcome the filibuster. But as pressure keeps building on lawmakers in the White House to get something done, while the effects of this shutdown on everyday Americans are becoming more and more serious, what kind of compromise might we see down the line? Laura Litvan is U.S. Senate and politics reporter for Bloomberg News, and she joins me now. Hi, Laura.
Good afternoon. How are you?
Good. Great to have you with us. And also on the line is Noah Bierman, White House reporter for the Los Angeles Times, who's been following all the shutdown ins and outs. Hi, Noah. Thanks for being on Air Talk.
Thanks for having me.
Really quickly with Laura first, what are these measures that the senators will be considering today? What exactly is on the table?
What they're considering is whether or not to bring up to begin debate on two rival proposals. The first is a Republican proposal that reflects the compromise that President Trump put forth over the weekend, which includes $5.7 billion for his border wall. It includes also some immigration law changes, which were supposed to be, were offered up as kind of bipartisan enticements, but which are running into a lot of opposition from Democrats. One are some new asylum limits on immigrant children from Central America, where they could not apply for asylum status at the U.S. border. They would have to do it someplace in Central America. The second one provides some deportation protections for young undocumented immigrants, but it doesn't go nearly as far as many Democrats would like, so it's running into a lot of opposition.
That's the DACA protections that are a three-year extension, right? And Democrats are saying, no way, we want basically the DREAM Act, a path to citizenship and a way for DACA recipients to eventually become citizens.
They want that, but what's troubling to them is when they actually saw the fine print of that part of this measure, it provides these three-year protections only for currently enrolled DACA recipients, not what they want, which is for other people who may also be eligible. So that has run in, that was a surprise to Democrats when they saw that a couple nights ago when it came out late in the evening, and they're crying foul over that. This vote will be followed by a Democratic proposal, which is really a bill that passed the House the first day of the shutdown. It would reopen shuttered federal agencies until February 8th, which would give more time, proponents say, to allow for negotiations on a border security compromise. It would, because it would reopen the government, it would trigger back pay and other pay for federal workers. And I would point out that actually the Senate, on a unanimous basis, actually passed this proposal in the Senate in the closing days of the Senate, the last session in December.
Yeah, and that was when we heard the president would not support this, and it was thrown into question whether we would ever get to a compromise to reopen the government. Laura Litvan with Bloomberg News, who's covering what's going on in Congress today, especially the Senate taking up these two bills opposing funding measures from Democrats and Republicans. So, you know, if the Democratic measure were to somehow garner enough votes from Republicans to actually pass, Laura, what we're looking at is just kind of kicking the can a few weeks down the road, right?
Yes. Well, and also it would simply start a debate on it. It could be changed in the floor if it actually made it that far, you could, for instance, change the date and move the date of reopening the government a little bit further down the line, do something like that. And then we'd have to see if it could even pass at the end. The fact of the matter is we are not anticipating that that measure will pass, even though it actually is, you know, we were just discussing, it had passed just weeks ago in the Senate. That's because Republican leaders are really pushing their rank and file to stick together behind the president, at least for a little bit longer here, and help to defeat this today. A lot of Republicans are concerned about standing, you know, taking a stand on this right now. Some are up for a re-election in 2020 and are worried about primary challengers and are trying to navigate this vote. And I think a few Republicans we can see are probably going to support that once the first Trump proposal fails, but probably not enough to get it over the line.
And that's, we're looking at like Cory Gardner from Colorado, who's up in 2020. Who else are we maybe considering as a centrist Republican who could decide to support the clean funding measure?
Susan Collins has been very cagey about how she may vote. She's also on the ballot in 2020. We think she may also join Gardner in supporting it. Lisa Murkowski just told one of our reporters about half an hour ago that she will be supporting that measure. So there are at least a handful of Republicans who may do so.
Really, and thanks, Laura Litvin with Bloomberg News, who's on the line with me right now. Noah Bierman here from the Los Angeles Times, White House reporter. Noah, it sounds like this is really hinging on the president, that Senate Republicans don't want to do anything that is not going to get White House support eventually. What are you hearing out of the White House in terms of, will there be any more concessions after that Saturday announcement?
Yeah, I mean, that's the big picture issue for Trump, is that members of Congress from his own party have felt burned by past, believing they had White House support on things, taking a tough vote, and then seeing the president change his mind or publicly undermine what they've already voted on. We're seeing right now the White House holding a very strong line in public and in private. But there are some factors that if the president does decide to change his mind and push for some way out of this impasse, there are some factors, I think, that are pushing him right now that could do it. I mean, what we know from the past is that the president is going to push hard until and if he does change his mind. It's not going to be a subtle thing. And we see, at the top of the broadcast, you heard the news report of Wilbur Ross's comments. There have been some comments that have been embarrassing to the White House.
Yeah, seems very out of touch with the realities of missing multiple paychecks for the average federal worker, to be confused about why federal workers might be reaching out to food banks or homeless shelters, as Secretary Ross was.
Yeah, and you saw that, and you see, I mean, there's continuing to be some polling that's not looking good for the president, and there was one in particular from Fox over the last day, which he watches closely, that found 51% of the public blaming the president and 34% blaming Democrats. That's been pretty consistent, but his popularity is going. His popularity number is getting lower during this period. That's going to concern him. And then there are economic issues. In addition to those microeconomic issues that are raised by the Wilbur Ross comments, there are macro ones about, although we won't get economic growth numbers next week because of the shutdown, Larry Kudlow just came out a few minutes ago to try and reassure the public. So they're trying to do things clearly concerned about the economic impacts.
Yeah, unpredictability is not great for markets, it turns out. Noah Bierman with the LA Times, I'm curious, this State of the Union back and forth between Nancy Pelosi and President Trump, does it matter ultimately in these negotiations? Is it a big deal that it appears Speaker Pelosi has succeeded in delaying the State of the Union until the budget deal has come to a fruition?
Well, I think it matters for a number of reasons. One is, it's just exacerbated the nature of the personal anger here in Washington between the president and Democrats. And that's likely to continue if and when we get out of the shutdown for future negotiations on issues. It establishes Pelosi's ability to remind the president that, Congress is a separate branch of government and can wield power. He does not like to back down, and he did. There is a dream scenario, however unlikely, that, you know, they could resolve all this by Tuesday. The Senate could suspend, allow unanimous consent to push things through, and then he emerges triumphantly to deliver a State of the Union with the government open Tuesday, because he does like a dramatic entrance and a sort of reality TV reveal. But that also appears unlikely, just timing-wise and because the sides are just still so far apart.
Oh, you started out so optimistic there, Noah, and then it kind of turned a little less. Laura Litvan is also on the line with me with Bloomberg News. Laura, I know what the White House wants here. It's the $5.7 billion in border wall spending. It's the steel slats or the wall, whatever you want to say. But what's Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer's border security plan? Have Democrats successfully gotten their message across about an alternative?
Well, it's interesting you ask that, because there is actually now, you know, some kind of a counterproposal in the works on the House side. And I think that's where attention will turn next. What we do know is about, you know, where they had been was in coming into the fall. There was a bipartisan agreement in the Senate to provide $1.6 billion for border security. Trump, coming into the year, had only asked for $1.6 billion for a wall. They were going to do border security, and they moved this through the Senate. And then Pelosi and Schumer lowered that a little bit when they started heading into their own talks with the president to $1.3 billion. And then now we have the Democrats in the House potentially looking at a much bigger package that would be border security and other immigration law, immigration funding, related funding. And they're looking at something that they say might be as much as $5.7 billion, including more immigration law judges, more infrastructure, including like protections at ports of entry. They have given very little detail in terms of what they're looking at. And we do know that at least today it's not coming, but they're hoping to pull something together maybe tomorrow or early next week to have some kind of a counterproposal. And we'll have to see if that moves the needle at all. It may be asking the president to accept a much bigger number on border security than anyone had ever imagined, but they still probably will not give him a wall.
Laura Litvan with Bloomberg News. I know you have to go. We've been speaking with you from the Senate Press Gallery. I'm sure you have a lot going on today. I thank you so much for your analysis and reporting, and we'll be following it as this whole thing unfolds. Thanks, Laura.
Thank you very much.
And Noah Bierman, just really quickly with you from the Los Angeles Times, what's next for the White House? What's the next move if Democrats do indeed pull out this alternative strategy that maybe has $5.7 billion in some type of funding, not necessarily just wall funding? What do you think the White House's next steps are?
Well, it's such an open question because so much of it is just Trump individually. The White House, writ large, there are all kinds of people with all kinds of hopes that this does end. And certainly the involvement of Mitch McConnell now does give another opportunity that maybe it's coming closer to an end, because he had stayed out of the way for a while. And he does have a history dating back to the shutdown of 2013 of letting people in his party sort of have a teachable moment by shutting down the government and then seeing, showing them the limits of that strategy. And maybe that's what this vote is about today, showing the president, okay, we're trying to get your bill passed, but this is as far as we can get. Why don't we come up with a plan B here? And so, if there's a way out, that might be part of it. But so much, so much can happen because consistently, not just with the shutdown, but including the shutdown, the president will seem on board with some new strategy, some new way out, only to see the reaction of some of his base supporters in the media turn against that strategy. And he's persuaded. He's really afraid of losing that base.
Right, because if Ann Coulter suddenly calls him Jeb Bush, as she did over the weekend, saying that Trump's base voted for Trump but got Jeb, does that just back him into a corner where he doesn't have the flexibility to compromise? We only have about a minute here, Noah, but what's your take on that?
Yeah, I mean, that's the big issue, and that's why members of Congress want his personal assurance and are hoping that even with his personal assurance that it's in blood, that he's not going to change his mind. We saw there was a big spending bill the last time that he said he would never do this again. where they took a vote that they thought was hard, and then he called it a terrible bill and still signed it. It was one of the most unusual signing ceremonies I've ever witnessed. Usually there are, you know, moments where you're passing out pens and praising all the people who helped get us where we are today. You don't usually hold a ceremony to sign a bill that you hate, but he did that to reopen the government the last time. It hadn't actually closed, but to keep it open.
Mm, so maybe Mitch McConnell signaling here that he is not able to go any further could prevent that kind of an awkward situation from the Congress and the president coming up here. Noah Bierman with the Los Angeles Times, who's been following all the ins and outs of what's going on in Washington over the government shutdown. Thank you very much for being here on Air Talk.
Great being on. Thanks a lot.
It's Libby Denkman in for Larry Mantle. Coming up next, our new boss is in studio. Herb Scannell is going to join me and answer your questions in just a minute here on KPCC. Welcome back to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Libby Denkman in for Larry Mantle today, and we have big news here at KPCC. Our Board of Trustees has chosen a new leader for the organization, Southern California Public Radio. Here, he's coming to us with a ton of experience from the world of cable television. He's the former president of Nickelodeon. He served as head of BBC America and the Latinx media outlet MeToo. And until yesterday, he was on the board of WNYC, the public radio powerhouse in New York. It's not every day that you interview your boss's boss's boss, so this is very exciting for me. I'm pleased to introduce the new president and CEO of Southern California Public Radio, Herb Scannell, in studio with me now. Hello, welcome.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
It's great to have you here. I just wanted to note that you're going to be officially starting in February, and our longtime president and CEO, Bill Davis, is going to stay with SCPR as president emeritus. So we thank him for sticking around and being part of the organization going forward. I want to get to your biography in just a minute, but I think the most important question that I can possibly pose to you is about our listeners and our members, because really, they are our largest and most reliable source of funding, as we always say, and it's very true. And I want to hear, what do you hope to do for members and for our audience at KPCC going forward as you lead us into, you know, the next generation?
Well, great question. You know, for me, you know, public media and public the best media in media is public media and public radio. So I am a longtime listener to this station. When I was in New York, I listened to this station, and vice versa. But you know, this city's really got it going on right now. I mean, having been here, I've been living here for about a year and a half, and the energy is fantastic. I've been living downtown, and my discovery of a lot of new areas that I didn't know. When I was an executive in New York, I mostly stay on the West Side, and so the East Side's been, you know, really a great experience for me.
Did you know that LA has a downtown before you moved here?
You know, the truth was, I probably came downtown, you know, less than a handful of times for probably events, you know, but I didn't really know much about the downtown. But it is a, you know, it's really, there's so much activity. It is bustling, and the restaurants, and I've enjoyed my time downtown. But back to your question, you know, look, public media right now, you know, I think has got a crucial place in the media landscape more now than ever, you know, with the nature of, you know, journalism kind of, you know, being eroded locally, especially as newspapers diminish and or disappear. You know, it's more and more the void is being filled by folks like us and KPCC. And I know when I was a listener, you know, I always prefer – you know, I have Sirius, but I don't go to the NPR feed. I go to KPCC because I want the combination of local and national. And the local news that I get from KPCC, you know, I leaned in on the election. That's when I was getting my information about what was going on, especially the Orange County elections that were, you know, flipping, you know, back and forth. You know, there was a piece that was done this summer in advance or soon after Coachella about, you know, how the other side of Coachella, away from the glamour and glitz. And I thought that was, you know, that's what public media.
So digging in on these really hyper-local issues
yes.
that affect Southern Californians because, you know, coming to us, you know, as a transplant and from one transplant to another, you know, we obviously welcome that. But of course, you have some things to learn about L.A. And I'm wondering, what do you know that you don't know about L.A.?
Well, I know the GPS will be a good friend of mine.
Yes.
And also Larry is going to be a good friend of mine because I'm told Larry has lived in every nook and cranny in Los Angeles. So we just talked about that yesterday. So, you know, look, I need to know more about the geography. And you know, I do know that one of the things that I really, truly appreciate about my time here and what I feel more now in living downtown and having spent a lot more time in the East Side is just, you know, this is a wonderfully diverse city. I mean, it is in some ways, people talk about, you know, the nature of multicultural cities and the future, you know, what's going to happen tomorrow. What's not happening tomorrow, it's happening today right here. And we're a poster child of what good can look like, you know. If we can do it here, you know, we can do it anywhere. And, oh, that's a New York line, but I'm going to take it and appropriate it for Los Angeles.
You've brought it to Los Angeles.
Yeah.
I do want to ask about your background in, mm-hmm. and growing up in New York because you're from Long Island. Can you talk to me a little bit about your upbringing and, you know, how that informs who you are today?
Yeah, so I grew up, you know, 40 miles from New York City, so I'm a suburbanite. So the folks that live, you know, in the suburbs, I feel you. And sometimes, you know, the city can be, you know, the only connection you have to it is through media. I remember as a kid, you know, there'd be hospital strikes in Brooklyn and we lived in Huntington, Long Island. And, you know, we didn't know what was going on there. But and then the gravitational pull of cities is incredible. And as you get older, you know, you end up using and going to the city. Me being a man of high culture, it happened to be a time when the Knicks were good, which was a short period of time. So I would go into the Garden and take the train in. And go to concerts and things like that, but the you know the experience that I had was my parents were social workers, so I grew up not with a sense that I would be working in media. You know, I'm one of those guys that kind of got lucky, and my luck was that I loved radio. I was a kid. I used to sit down, take a loose leaf piece of paper, write 1 through 20, and Tuesday nights, you know, Cousin Brucey would count down the survey. It shows my age when I say something like that on WABC. And I just write down the songs, and I would, you know, I was tuned into radio, literally.
Yeah.
And then I went to college, and I managed a college radio station at Boston College. And my first job out of college was I knew one guy that worked in media. I didn't even know what media was, but I knew one guy that worked in radio. And he had left to go to cable, and he said, call this person I interviewed. And then cable actually sourced a lot of people in the early days from radio. And so that's how I ended up in the cable business.
That's how you moved into that that other life in the cable news and cable programming business. I want to get to that in just a second because Nickelodeon was a very formative thing in my life, especially growing up. And I'm really fascinated by that. I know your family life. Your mom is Puerto Rican and your dad is Irish. Mm-hmm. Did you speak Spanish at home? How did the Puerto Rican side of your family kind of inform who you became and how you grew up?
Well, you know, it is – the answer is, you know, our household was culturally Latino or Puerto Rican specifically because we had 13 cousins on my mom's side and my dad had one brother and no kids. And my uncle, who I'm named after, I love dearly, and we were incredibly close. But when it came to family, we swung – and literally I think we got airdropped down to Puerto Rico every other summer or so and, you know, stayed with our cousins. And it was like kind of a cultural exchange program as they came – and stayed with us, and we stayed with them. And, you know, it was very influential in many ways because, you know, we grew up, you know, we were in the suburbs and we were, you know, my mom was – there wasn't in a deep community. And when she was in the city, it was a very different dynamic. With that said, you know, the thing about it was it lived large in our lives. I mean, I had rice and beans. I never ate potatoes. We never had potatoes. My mother thought a good – a good mashed potato was out of a box, right?
Yeah.
So that was a different kind of upbringing. And then my parents being social workers, you know, that was, you know, that kind of, you know, influenced me. And, you know, I always thought that I would probably go into the family business And then, you know, as I said, I ended up managing a radio station in college, met somebody, and then ended up going to cable. And then, you know, the run at Nickelodeon was a good run because Nickelodeon was this kind of great balance, you know, of mission and commerce, you know. Mm. We wanted to change the face of kids' TV, literally.
And you really did. I remember thinking that, you know, my mind was blown by shows like Pete and Pete and Doug, yeah. Rugrats, Clarissa Explains It All. I do not want to make you feel old, but I was a kid. I mean, those were right in my wheelhouse. And I remember thinking that they were really off the wall, a lot of the concepts, but they just spoke to me, and I was glued to that programming. So I'm curious, as an executive, what your role is in encouraging that sort of creativity and risk-taking in the content that's coming out of your shop? Because, you know, I definitely saw it at Nickelodeon, and public media has been taking some risks, but we also are, you know, known to be kind of staid and traditional in our ways. What's your role as an executive in promoting that kind of creativity?
Well, you know, I think it's, you know, it's meaningful, and I do think that ultimately – you know, when it comes to things like the screens and who populates the screens, it's about leadership. And, you know, Nickelodeon's built on some very sound principles, one of which was we like kids just the way they were, with teeth, without teeth, big, small, of color, you know, whatever it might be. And then, you know, once if you believe that, then you got to show it. And that's what we did. And, you know, we were different than probably, you know, we didn't think about diversity as a hardship. We thought of it as like a, you know, as a strength and potentially a source of energy. When you put people into TV that aren't usually seen in TV, creatively, it opens up great possibilities. So, you know, and that was kind of what we did a couple of times, you know, there was a period when I was the president when, you know, we would, you know, literally have offsites and we'd ask the question, what's wrong with this picture? And we didn't have many Latinos, just before the census, and we just thought, well, we knew that we didn't know how big the numbers were, you know, because that 2000 census was a landmark census, but we knew that, you know, we needed to serve all audiences.
Is that how Dora the Explorer, a program like that, happens? I mean, that is, you know, one of the first introductions to bilingual programming that I ever remember seeing in kids programming. I mean, is that something that you can see having a place in public media, a bilingual program or some type of offering for our audience?
Yeah, I think we have to connect to audiences, and we connect to audiences and what's true and relevant to them, you know. Back to the nature of kids just the way they are. You know, we weren't trying to make perfect kids. We were trying to capture real kids. And I think that the, you know, the best brands, the best products oftentimes capture real and authentic experiences. So, you know, in what we do here, you know, I think, you know, this is a, you know, this city that is full of, you know, people of color and people of different backgrounds is something that we want to lean into, you know, and we reflect them in our products, and we need to know what's on their minds, and we need to know the issues that are there. And that's what we need to do both as journalists and also as storytellers.
You were board chair at New York Public Radio, which runs WNYC from 2009 to 2013. And you served on that board since 2000. And I understand that you actually resigned yesterday as this whole transition was happening to become president and CEO here at KPCC. And just to reiterate, I'm speaking with Herb Scannell. He's the new president and CEO of our organization, Southern California Public Radio. I'm curious what you learned from working in public radio in New York and how that would apply to Los Angeles.
Mm. I think I learned a lot. You know, one was I had a sense of, you know, we were pretty strategic in the way that we approached, you know, what was emerging in audio. I think I mentioned to some of the members of the staff, but, you know, we got into podcasting early. Alec Baldwin wanted to do a podcast, didn't necessarily want to do a weekly show, so we did Here's the Thing. And we did Freakonomics with Stephen Dubner. He didn't want to do a weekly radio show, but he wanted to do something in audio. So we got in early, and we were very thoughtful about why podcasts made sense, which was, you know, think about ultimately what's happened in TV was, you know, broadcasts got, you know, kind of trumped by cable because things like Nickelodeon were for kids, not for everybody. And now Netflix, you know, they're doing things really well, but ultimately, you know, they're trumping cable because they're taking – it's about you. It's not just about a group of you. It's about you. And podcasts are about you. You know, you pick. You
it's
decide.
Very personal. And that connection is very personal. I think about Two Dope Queens out of WNYC. It's a really personal connection with the audience. You know, audio storytelling and journalism is really capturing attention because this podcasting thing, it turns out, is really cool right now. And you see a ton of new programming coming out. You see a lot of big powerhouses getting into the market. How can KPCC compete when you do see a New York Times and a Washington Post pouring a lot of resources into original podcasting programming? What is our value proposition?
Well, first of all, there are so many stories. You know, there was a movie called L.A. Story. So let's be clear, right? There are so many stories that come out of, emanate from L.A., from its history, from its people and all that, that, you know, have yet to be told. Add into that that California is the fifth biggest economy in the world. So what matters here matters everywhere. So that alone is, you know, anchor material for telling stories. And then I would add that, you know, in our backyard is Hollywood, and that's where storytellers thrive, live. There's no better gift than Hollywood when it comes to creative culture. So to me, those are all opportunity areas for KPCC to tap. And you know, and then the nature of, you know, going into this kind of a podcast is just a matter. Also, it's about younger audiences, more diverse audiences. To your point, more personal stories. You know, when you're playing in a field where it's about me, you don't necessarily, you could make things that are more customized to specific audiences. So that's opportunity for all of us, right? And with that said, I also think it's opportunity in journalism. You know, when one of the, you asked earlier about my growing up in Long Island, and there was a piece done right around the election, a podcast called The Divided States of America. It was about Long Island, and Long Island was much like Orange County. It was it was all about aerospace. 800,000 people at Grumman, you know, and much like Orange County, I believe, right? And but it was about the birth of the suburbs ultimately, as they explained why Long Island was more characteristic of New Hampshire. It would have been a purple state if it were not part of New York State.
So that kind of depth and that kind of history, the context that's possible in a podcast format that's just not possible in a 30-second news update or a 4-minute newscast. You know, I'm also curious about your time at WNYC because we do have to kind of, think about one of the occurrences while you were on the board there. WNYC had a high-profile Me Too case, and that was the accusations of harassment and unwanted touching and bullying against John Hockenberry, one of their high-profile hosts. His contract wasn't renewed in 2017. A couple of other New York Public Radio hosts were fired after that investigation, separate investigations into their workplace conduct. I'm curious what you think about the handling of these cases and how should organizations ensure that there is accountability and a safe workplace and a fair workplace for everyone.
Sure. Well, you know, it was, it really did make the organization very reflective, and I think that was an important thing that came out of it, and it went deep in terms of the way that the organization became more aware of what was happening in terms of gender and other issues, that were in the workplace. And I think that was a value that came out of it. With that said, you know, ultimately, you know, we've got to create organizations where people are not feeling that they are bullied. They're not feeling that they are that there is some kind of divine right that somebody has to as a boss. And you know, oftentimes organizations are overly hierarchical, and it can be on shows and otherwise. You know, and you know, you got to create a culture that's very different. My personal feeling about culture, it's never been the ends justify the means. A better means makes for better ends. And treating people, you know, fairly, respectfully is the way that, you know, a good organization will run. So culture is very important. From what I've seen here, you've got a good culture. So, you know, my hope here is just to be a part of something that has that kind of respect for the people that work here.
And we do have to wrap. I could continue talking forever because you just never get this opportunity to get the thoughts of your boss. Anything else that you want to add? Herb Scannell, who is the new president and CEO of KPCC and Southern California Public Radio, for your hopes for your time here and your leadership going forward.
Yeah. Well, you know, I just want to say again that that I'm so happy to have the opportunity I want to thank, you know, many people, the board, but I'm most interested in meeting you guys. And I would say that Bill Davis, what he started here, was really something special. And, you know, I've had in my past history, I was lucky enough to have Jerry Laybourne, who started Nickelodeon, be my, you know, I succeeded her. And the good news is I didn't mess it up. So, Bill, I'm not going to mess it up, and thank you for the good work that you did to get this thing going.
Yeah, Bill really grew this station and has done amazing things here. So we all thank Bill for what he's done, and we're excited about your leadership as well. Herb Scannell, thank you very much.
Thank you.
It's Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Libby Denkman. Back after this news. It's Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Libby Denkman in for Larry Mantle today. Not too long ago, LA County voters approved a 1 cent sales tax that's expected to nearly double Metro's rail capacity. But the car is still king here in Southern California. Environmentalists, urban planners, and transit advocates have long struggled with how to convince more people to ride public transportation. Well, a recent article in Wired magazine suggests part of that conversation should be centered on women and making sure female riders feel safe on LA's buses and trains. I have some guests that I want to talk to about this, but I also want to get your take. If you call in right now, please share your experience with public transit in LA. Do you commute by metro or bus? Have you felt safe using transit? Has personal safety played a role in your decision to drive or take the metro? You can call us at 866-893-5722. That's 866-893-5722. You can also comment on the AirTalk page or on Twitter and Facebook. And that tag is at AirTalk. Joining me now to discuss some new research about the gender disparity in ridership is Marlon Bornett, professor of public policy and chair of urban planning at USC. Professor, thank you so much for being on AirTalk today.
Thank you for having me.
And also in the studio with me is Anastasia Lukaitu-Sideris, who is professor of urban planning at UCLA, and her research includes public transportation and women's safety issues. I appreciate you coming in studio.
Delighted to be here.
So I want to start with you, Professor Bornett. Wired cites this paper that was presented last week at the annual Transportation Research Board meeting, and it posits that women are choosing gas-guzzling vehicles over cleaner commutes, even though they do care about the environment. And one of the reasons that they cited in a survey was that they feel unsafe on transit. I understand you worked on some research regarding gender disparity in transit. Can you discuss what you discovered and what your steps were to finding that data?
Yes, happy to. And what Wired was citing was some research that I have done with Xingping Xu and Doug Houston, and I want to be sure to give them credit. We had took a look at the opening of the phase one of the Expo Line. And your listeners may recall that occurred around 2012. When that happened, it gave us an opportunity to do a before and after comparison. And we tracked travel for survey subjects before and after that rail line opened. And what we found was that on average, for people who lived within a half mile of the new stations, they increased their rail ridership by 4.3% in terms of number of trips after the train opened, but that effect was about half as small for women. And we did ask survey subjects a set of questions querying their fear for safety, their fear of harassment, and we were able to attribute about 20% of the smaller rail ridership impact among women to concerns about safety and harassment. And so I do think that there's some pretty solid evidence, at least from that case, that women are using transit less and that a good part of that is due to concern about safety.
Did that surprise you, Professor Bornett, or have you observed this in prior research on transit, that safety is a deciding factor when it comes to ridership?
You know, it did not surprise me. There's been a literature going back really a couple of decades that has documented that concerns about safety are real among women, that that concern is much larger among women than among men, and that it does reduce ridership. Anastasia is really, I think, the bigger expert in that literature than I am. She's done work in that. But I have to say that there was nothing about that that was surprising. I wish I had been surprised.
Anastasia Lukaitu-Sedaris in studio with me now from UCLA. When you saw that data, you were nodding just now. You've observed this for many years. You've worked in this field for a long time.
Yes, absolutely. We do know, as Marlon mentioned, that women are typically more afraid of riding transit, but also waiting at the bus stop, walking towards the bus stop. And I would add, for some good reasons, because especially when it comes to issues of harassment, we find that surveys have found, some of these my own surveys, some surveys from other colleagues have found that women typically are much more harassed and victimized than men. Right now, we are undertaking a survey of college students at UCLA, and we're asking both male students and female students if you have been harassed on transit, and we find there is huge difference in the responses of women saying, yes, we have been harassed, versus their the male students that have much less been harassed.
And we're going to take your calls at 866-893-5722 to weigh in on that. If you are somebody who has experienced safety issues on the metro, or perhaps you're a commuter and you have not seen any issues, I want to get your experience. 866-893-5722. We already have a caller on the line, and we'll get to them right after a very short break. It's Libby Denkman here on Air Talk. Back on Air Talk now, we're talking about the disparity between men and women riding public transit and some research that has been done by USC and some other universities into why women may be choosing cars over transit. Marlon Bornett with USC has joined me now, professor of public policy and chair of urban planning, and he was just describing a study where they surveyed Expo Line neighbors, people that live near that line, and discovered that a lot of women were reporting not using transit because of safety concerns. Anastasia Lukaitu-Sedaris, also here from UCLA. I want to get a quick call on the line. Elena in Westchester is here. And Elena, you're talking about the differences between train lines, right? What is your experience?
Well, I'm not a commuter any longer. I'm retired, and I do like to take the lines as much as I can, and I find that there's a great difference between the various lines in terms of how I feel. I mean, I've never actually been attacked, but there are, you know, it's the microaggressions that one feels, you know, or somebody on the line who's riding with you that, you know, just doesn't have the same kind of personal boundaries as I have.
Sure, sure.
That makes me feel unsafe. But contrary to the researchers, I found the Expo Line to be probably the safest feeling of all of them. And particularly when I'm riding the stretch, like, between USC and Santa Monica. And I think it's because there's a lot of, you know, sort of more mainstream sorts of people riding that line. But the Blue Line, I've tried to ride from time to time and honestly have felt so unsafe, you know, even during daylight hours, that I just gave up on it.
Elena in Westchester, I thank you so much for calling in. And I want to get your take, Anastasia Lukaitu-Sedaris from UCLA, about that. I think Elena saying, you know, more mainstream people on a certain line, you know, it's, we're kind of dancing around the issue that the metro is something that provides access to low-income people, mm-hmm. to diverse folks, people of color, maybe people that don't have access to personal vehicles as well. What is your take on somebody who basically says, I feel uncomfortable because there maybe are people that aren't in my same social circle or socioeconomic level?
Well, you know, these are sometimes perceptions about fear, and these perceptions are quite often significant because they may detract someone from using the line. However, a lot of these, what I want to say, and she talked about microaggressions, and this is actually something that often a lot of women are afraid and they do not report. It is not only, you know, important or serious crime that affects women, but also obscene language or particular stares that you can that often women are much more sensitive to than men.
But what are solutions when it comes to a transit agency trying to combat this and bring more women into ridership? What can you do about a situation where you're trying to serve all of Los Angeles and there are people who don't feel comfortable with somebody else's? Maybe there are folks who have a mental illness or somebody who doesn't have the same, as Elena was mentioning, sense of personal space. How does a transit agency serve everyone while encouraging, you know, a greater ridership going forward?
Well, there are a number of things that transit agencies can do. For example, people tend to feel better if they are surrounded by more people, but of course not too close. Sometimes, and we're talking about rail lines, but actually most people are scared, most women are scared, not when they're on the bus or on the train, but when they are waiting for the bus. And so, you know, the type of lighting, where you position your bus stop so that it is more surrounded by establishments where you have more foot traffic. This all plays a role. On the bus, the driver can invite women. You can have dedicated places near the bus driver. Quite often, in some transit agencies, not that many, allow women drivers to step off the bus in a place that may not be the bus stop, but is nearer their destination. These are some things.
To make sure that they don't need to have such a long walk to their home. I'm curious, and we're short on time, but you know, there's an issue of balance here with maybe over-policing. There are people who are calling for more sheriff's deputies or more police on metro lines. But again, this is a situation where low-income people, people of color, may feel like their space is being invaded and that they are being targeted unfairly, which research shows has happened. Is there a danger of over-policing as well when we try to make the rail lines safer for women specifically?
Yes, absolutely. And if you noticed, all the items that I've mentioned did not involve policing, because there are certain things that you can do through policy and through design that could help some of these issues. So, as I mentioned, feeling surrounded by other fellow passengers is important, and so that you don't feel that you are in a kind of a desolate space. But also having some dedicated space. There are other issues in addition to safety that would help women feel more comfortable. Quite often they are carrying strollers and they're accompanied by young kids. Where do you place the stroller on the vehicle?
It's a huge issue.
It's a huge
and
issue.
Absolutely. I do have to run just because of time constraints, but Anastasia Lukaitu-Sedaris, who is an expert on urban planning at UCLA, and her research includes public transportation and women's safety. We also heard from Marlon Bornett at USC. I'm Libby Dankman with KBCC, in for Larry Mantle today. More coming up after this.
KBCC podcasts are supported by Pepperdine's Graduate School of Education and Psychology, offering a doctorate of education in organizational leadership, developing graduates with the knowledge and ability to transform organizations for optimal success and growth, offering an online hybrid format in West LA with attendance only twice per term, tailored for working professionals. Classes start September. Apply by February 18th to be considered for a $3,000 scholarship opportunity at gsep.pepperdine.edu.
When an earthquake hits, you need to drop, cover, and hold on.
Definitely there will be the perception that the ground is literally waving in front of you.
But what do you do after the shaking stops? When the power is out, the roads are blocked. I'm Jacob Margolis, host of KPCC's new podcast, The Big One, your survival guide. I've got plenty of answers for you. Listen in Apple Podcasts.
You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Libby Denkman, in for Larry Mantle while he takes a day off. We'll have more coverage of the partial government shutdown on Air Talk right now. As you just heard from NPR News, the Senate is preparing to vote on a pair of proposals to reopen the government. Neither one is likely to pass, the GOP and the Democratic plan, but we will bring you all the latest on that if a vote happens in the next hour or so. A second missed paycheck is looming for federal employees. Friday is fast approaching. And as I said, no deal is likely from the president or lawmakers in D.C. And government agencies are feeling the squeeze. Several former DHS secretaries sent a letter to the president yesterday urging him to fund that department. While the union representing FBI agents has said terrorism investigations are being stalled by the lack of funding. So what's going on in your life? We want to hear from you. We want to take the temperature of the Air Talk audience right now. You can call us at 866-893-5722 to weigh in. That's 866-893-5722. I want to hear from you if you work for the federal government or your paycheck depends in some way on the government or you have a family member whose does. What has this shutdown meant for you? What are you seeing in your everyday life? How is your family getting by? Call us at 866-893-5722. And here to talk about the business side of all of this, financial markets and what this is doing for corporations, Gabriel Rubin is a reporter at the Wall Street Journal's Washington, D.C. Bureau, where he covers financial regulation. And he tweets at the charming handle Rubinations. I like that. Gabriel, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for the confidence. Good to be here.
So you've been covering the impact of the shutdown on businesses and finance. What are you seeing big picture in terms of what this partial shutdown has done?
Well, I think just the length of this shutdown has really been a wake-up call for people just to see how many disparate parts of the economy really depend on various parts of the government, parts that, you know, most people, even people who look at this stuff very closely, just might not have realized before we stretched into, you know, a month of this shutdown. One of the things that probably appeals to, would be of interest to your audience is the fact that small business contractors just in the state of California have already lost $183 million that they depend on the government to pay.
Oh my gosh.
These are not government employees. These are small business employees and small businesses that, you know, do work for the government and are used to getting, you know, quite regular income from government agencies. And you know, these businesses really rely on the government for, in some cases up to, you know, all of their revenue. And the government's usually good at paying its invoices, except when it's not.
Yeah, I mean, the unpredictability of this is really the tough thing because, again, like you said, they depend on this what should be a reliable chunk of their business. And now we are in this stalemate that we just don't see an end to. And I think, Gabriel, especially your reporting with the Wall Street Journal has really kind of given me a tutorial and exactly what all these government agencies do that I didn't even really contemplate. I mean, you know, things like the Securities and Exchange Commission and the way that it has, you know, been now because of the partial shutdown. IPOs can't go forward. Banking regulation is still operating. But I mean, there's just a ton of stuff in here that you don't even consider what the government does until the gears grind to a halt and it stops working.
I think one good example of that, sticking on the small business theme, is the fact that nearly $2 billion, and that number goes up every day, of small business loans that are guaranteed by the Small Business Administration are currently in limbo, and they're not issuing any new loans. And a lot of small businesses really depend on that kind of backing to repair their businesses, to do an expansion of their business. And that's the stuff that really drives the economy. And when it's not, and when a dependable program like that isn't working, the overall economy really starts to feel the strain. And obviously, most acutely, those small business owners and their employees.
Gabriel Rubin is a reporter at The Wall Street Journal. He's covering the financial impact of the government shutdown. And I want to get to your calls. If you are a federal worker who is going to miss a second paycheck tomorrow, or perhaps your family member is, if you are impacted by this shutdown personally, 866-893-5722 to call in and let me know how you are seeing the effects right in your own life. 866-893-5722. I'm going to go to John in Glendale first. And John, you're a furloughed government employee. What are you experiencing?
Well, I'm experiencing a lot of stress, a lot of anxiety with not knowing when my agency and the government will be reopened. What I've been doing just in the last week is calling up my creditors, and on that side of the house, they have been helpful, some of them, in what they call forbearance with my mortgage company. They said I have a two-month forbearance there. I just got off the phone with my car lender, and just a matter of standing in another form, and they've allowed for 2 months also of non-payment. Now, with my credit card companies also, there's some stress there because I'm not 100% confident that this won't have some negative impact on my credit rating down the road, by what they're telling me that, okay, we'll go ahead and put you in a plan where you don't have to pay this month, et cetera. But at the end of those calls, I wasn't 100% sure that wouldn't eventually at some point down the road show up on my credit negatively. So, you know, still stressful situation. I don't know how much longer we can go on like this. I'm one of two in my family. Obviously, my wife is still working and bringing in income, but
And this is a furlough, so you are, ready, able to work, but you have just been told, for now, while the government shutdown is ongoing, you're a non-essential, and so you're not working, you're not getting paid. I mean, how does that feel to be ready and able and just knowing that you are, through no fault of your own, going to miss this paycheck?
Well, I'm in a situation where I'm an accepted employee, so I've been actually coming into work every other day now since December 26th to process mail. So it feels a little bit worse in the sense that I still have to come in to the office and do some, take care of some tasks that I've been asked to do and required to do and not getting paid. So it's demoralizing on that side. I've made some commentary in one or the other shows on the air here, Take Two, that, it's just demoralizing. From that side of the house, that I have to come in, know that I'm not getting paid, and not know when we'll reopen.
Yeah. John in Glendale, I really thank you for your call. And I, saying hang in there is just a small comfort to compared to what you're dealing with right now. I mean, negotiating with your credit card company and your car loan, it just sounds like this huge burden. And I think about it spread across 800,000 or so federal workers. John, thanks again for that call. And Avi is on the line in Santa Monica. Again, if you want to weigh in on the personal impact of this shutdown on your life, 866-893-5722. Or you can tweet us, you can go to the Facebook page, you can, email us on the show page, or call 866-893-5722. Avi in Santa Monica, what's going on in your life because of the federal government shutdown?
Well, we're indirectly affected in the sense that we are a family in Santa Monica who lived under rent control, and had to leave our house and looking for new housing. We have special needs children and qualify for low-income housing. And HUD is currently shut down. They are paying existing recipients of HUD, but taking in new applicants, allowing us to potentially get subsidies and or help from the government right now is not possible. So we're kind of stuck in that limbo while we look for new housing.
So the safety net that you were expecting, you know, being displaced out of your home and hoping to find a new home for your family, the safety net's not there for you because of this shutdown.
Right, which puts us in a very precarious situation because we have a move-out date, and there's a very good likelihood that we'll have to, you know, find some kind of alternative living.
Avi, I'm so sorry that you're going through that. I wonder, too, if maybe you can get in touch with the AirTalk show page once you are safely pulled over. It sounds like you're driving right now, because I would really like to stay in touch with you and know how this plays out. And as the hopefully compromise is approaching, it happens in time for your family. Thank you again. And I hope that you can reach out to us so that we can stay in touch and know how things play out.
I absolutely will. And I'm just wishing all the people who are, you know, displaced right now and not getting paid all the best. It's a horrible situation.
Yeah. Thank you for those well wishes. And Avi in Santa Monica, thanks for your call. Yi Kwan in Fullerton is on the line. And Yi Kwan, you work for the National Archives, I understand. What is your experience right now with the shutdown?
Yes, you know, we are the probably one of the fortunate ones that my spouse, she's working full time, and she's trying to make this situation pass by. But I'm not sure how long we can hold it. We had about 16 federal employees work at the Nixon Library as part of the National Archives, and it's devastating.
It's all shut down at this point, so nobody is working, and obviously no one's getting paid.
That's right.
And this is the library in Yorba Linda, I understand. Do you know if any other National Archive locations or anything else in the region that's affected? I mean, I'm assuming it's a system-wide situation.
Yeah. This is one of the presidential library museum system under National Archives. So the old presidential library and museum are closed, even though the foundation, you know, that part, they might open. But all the National Archive employees among the 13 presidential library and museums staff are not working. We are all followed.
Yeah, Yi Kwan, thank you very much. And what's your next step? I mean, are you going to be able to rely on your wife's paycheck for now, or are you going to have to start negotiating with credit card companies or your mortgage or anything like that to stay afloat?
Actually, I already had to talk to my two bankers and about our mortgages. They are going to give us a 3-month interest-free mortgage extension for now.
Okay, so you're getting a little bit of leeway, a little bit of slack here, and I'm hearing a lot of folks, and your calls at 866-893-5722 continuing to roll in. You're getting some slack, Yi Kwan, just like some other federal workers. But again, it's a very strange situation to be in this predicament where it, through no fault of your own, you're not working, not getting paid, or perhaps working and not getting paid and having to say, I can't pay my bills this month. Yi Kwan in Fullerton, thanks for your call. On the line with me is Gabriel Rubin, reporter at the Wall Street Journal. Gabriel, what's your reaction? I mean, the calls just keep rolling in from federal workers who, or people who do business with the federal government, who are experiencing the real effects to their pocketbooks of the shutdown.
I think that it just shows just how widespread the effects of this shutdown are, both on people who work directly for the federal government or their families do, or if they, you know, work for a contractor who deals with the federal government. And I think that there is also a lot of impacts that, you know, could become very evident in the coming weeks in terms of possible consumer harm, because things like the U.S. Food and Drug Administration have drastically curtailed their inspections of food processing companies. The Consumer Product Safety Commission isn't publicizing recalls. So for products like, say, an electronic that shocks you, accidentally, and they want to recall that, the government isn't helping publicize that. So people might not hear about this recall, and there could be some, unfortunately, there could be some real harm done and danger to people who don't hear about these things.
Sure. I mean, what's happening with the IRS right now, Gabriel Rubin with The Wall Street Journal? Because I'm confused. Some of the workers were called back, and it appears that if this continues, that that the tax returns and rebates will be processed, but not the entire IRS is working. What's going on?
Yeah, it's sort of a patchwork over at the IRS. The Trump administration really did not want something like tax refunds to take a hit as part of the shutdown, because that would really ratchet up the pressure. So the people who work at the IRS in charge of that are working currently. I don't believe they're getting paid. And other programs such as processing forms that mortgage lenders use to verify borrowers' incomes, those programs are back working, although the employees, again, are not getting paid. So it's really a patchwork over there. Even the programs that are functioning are not functioning at full speed. So the bottom line is, you can put in sort of temporary fixes for particular programs, but nothing is going to go back to normal until the government is fully reopened.
Yeah, Gabriel Rubin with The Wall Street Journal. I've been taking your calls at 866-893-5722 to share your experiences with the government shutdown. Morris in West Covina joins me now. Morris, what's your situation and how is the shutdown impacting you?
Yes, I'm 62 years old and I'm disabled. I've been homeless for 10 years, and I was housed 3 months ago. I finally have a roof over my head. I have bills in my name. I have a bank account, which I haven't had in 10 years. The Department of Housing and Urban Development, who helps me with my rent, are without funding. And it looks like I'm back on the street again.
And so right now you're waiting for rental assistance, but it's not coming because of the shutdown. How long, Morris, do you have until you may be no longer in that housing that you just got into?
The end of next month, end of February, is what they're saying.
Do you feel like there are any alternatives for you, county or city assistance or any alternatives at this point in order to keep that roof over your head? Or are you kind of facing, a do or die here?
Well, I've been going through this for quite a while. I mean, it took me, over 2 years just to get this housing. Section 8 is another possibility, but most of the people that I talk to with Section 8, they get the funds, but they don't find a place. They can't find a place to live. No, I've gone through a lot of different a lot of different people and a lot of different agencies. And, it's just really, really frustrating to finally get somewhere. And then, all of a sudden it's going to get turned off.
Yeah. Morris in West Covina. Can you also get in touch with us over the AirTalk page and keep in touch? Maybe you can hang on the line here and we can get your information just to, keep tabs on how you're doing and how this government shutdown continues to impact you. Because it just seems heartbreaking to see somebody who just, finally got into housing and the HUD funding lapse has caused this. Morris, thank you very much for the call. And maybe hang on so we can get your information, okay?
Yeah, no problem. Thank you.
Okay, thank you so much. I'm Libby Denkman in for Larry Mantle today. We're talking about the impacts of this partial government shutdown on everyday Angelenos, Southern Californians. We had on the line Gabriel Rubin, a reporter at the Wall Street Journal, to talk about the impact on business and just the really unexpected breadth and depth of the impacts of having the government partially shut down for 34 days. Gabriel, thank you so much for joining us and sharing your reporting.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
I'll be back right after this short break. Coming up, we are going to talk about this website that a lot of folks use when they are making decisions about where to go work next, about job hunting, and whether it is an accurate portrayal of companies. It's a rating website, and new research shows that the ratings may be open to manipulation. That's coming up next on KPCC. Stay with us. It's Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Libby Denkman in for Larry Mantle today. This segment is for job seekers, or anyone who has ever looked for a job, really. I want to know how you did it. These days, there are a number of websites where employees can anonymously rate the companies that they work for, including reporting their salaries and benefits and other opinions about managers. And that's to help other people decide if they want to work at that company also. The best-known example of these sites is Glassdoor, but a new report from the Wall Street Journal suggests that Glassdoor may not be so transparent after all. The journal found companies were boosting their own rankings by flooding the site with five-star ratings. And here to talk about it is Rolf Winkler, a technology investigative reporter for the Wall Street Journal, where he recently co-authored the piece, How Companies Secretly Boost Their Glassdoor Ratings. Welcome to Air Talk. Thanks so much for being here.
Thank you for having me, Libby.
So what were you looking to find out about Glassdoor? What did you set out to discover, and how did you go about digging into this website?
Great question. This story really was born from a lot of my previous reporting. I write about Silicon Valley for the Journal, and you frequently write about companies behaving badly, startups doing things they shouldn't. And all the time I'd hear sources tell me, apropos of nothing, you know, when the executives started asking us to, you know, we had negative Glassdoor ratings, and they said, well, can you go on and put a positive one on there to make us look better? And it just, you know, made me feel uncomfortable. And by the third or fourth time I heard that, I thought, you know, I'm going to go check in with our great crack data journalist team and have them kind of pull data from Glassdoor's website to see what they see. And sure enough, what my colleague found was that about 400 companies, many large companies, saw these very unnatural spikes in positive reviews that were just statistically very improbable to have happened by chance.
So, you know, just to be clear with our listeners about how Glassdoor works, it's basically like people log in, they can give a rating, a star rating to companies. And again, this is a way for other folks to decide if they want to go there. So if you're seeing ratings that are suspiciously being spiked suddenly, that may be communicating inaccurate information to other job seekers, right?
Yeah. So for your listeners who aren't familiar, Glassdoor is a lot like maybe Yelp for small local businesses, restaurants, or TripAdvisor for hotels. It's, but in this case, it's for companies. It's basically a site that collects reviews from employees, current and former, of companies. And yes, to your point, the question is, well, how much can we trust these reviews? And if there's a whole bunch of positive ones flooding in over a short period of days or weeks, is that really a representative, an accurate representation of that company and what it's like to work there?
Yeah, and that can cause, you know, a lot of folks who are trying to make a huge life decision, like choosing their next job, to maybe act on inaccurate information. In the studio with me right now is Lori Shreve-Blake. I want to hear more about the investigation that the Wall Street Journal conducted. But first of all, Lori Shreve-Blake, who is the senior director at the USC Career Center, I'm curious what your first reaction was when you heard about kind of the Glassdoor, the questions about ratings that the Wall Street Journal reporting raised. how do you think that can impact workers who are trying to, again, make this huge life decision?
Yes. Well, one thing that workers need to do is they need to glean their own information. It's great to look at Yelp or a Glassdoor kind of site, but what we tell our job seekers and candidates at USC is that they need to network and do informational interviews. And there's nothing like firsthand information versus hearsay. I looked at some of the different reviews from around regarding the employers, and some of them were sweeping generalities. All of the jobs are dead end jobs. That's not good information. And when we're
those were reviews on Glassdoor.
And I think when people are looking at an organization, especially the big ones, you know, there are many different cultures within a big organization. So, you know, looking at USC or Disney, there are many divisions, many departments. And at the end of the day, you're going to be working in one department with one leader and a group of coworkers. And what's the culture in that specific organization? And you find that out through informational interviewing, networking. That's the first opportunity to kind of glean information. And so I think people need to rely on their own due diligence and hard work as it relates to getting the true sense of what is it like in the larger organization and then drilling down to the department that I'm going to be working
in. Yeah, what your actual job will be. I'm curious to hear from callers how you determine whether a company is the right place for you before you take a job. Do you use a site like Glassdoor? Do you call people like Lori is suggesting? Do your own networking? And have you ever taken a job and realized that it was a terrible idea? Maybe it was a bad workplace culture or the job was much different than it was originally sold. If you have a story to tell, 866-893-5722 is the number to call. Again, 866-893-5722 for workplaces that maybe turned out to be a little different than initially sold when you applied for the job. On the line is Rolf Winkler, technology investigative reporter from the Wall Street Journal. And he recently had a great report about the possibilities for manipulation in the job, the company review website, Glassdoor. Rolf, is flooding the site with positive reviews by encouraging your employees to, you know, log in and give you 5 stars, as you discovered was happening with many major companies in this report, is that acceptable practice from Glassdoor's perspective? I mean, are they trying to police this at all?
Well, hard to say. They'll say that they do police it, but the data suggests that they're a little laissez-faire about actually maybe stopping companies. And it's sort of at that point, you really need to dig in a little bit to understand the business model. And Glassdoor is a site that at the end of the day is paid by the companies that are reviewed. Their pages go up automatically. If you review a company, your company, a page is suddenly created out of their control. But, you know, later on, when it starts attracting more traffic, Glassdoor can then basically sell the page to the company so that they get additional features. They can, you know, feature a positive review at the top. So with that in mind, you start to see that, well, the question becomes, is Glassdoor managing its content, those reviews? Is it managing it for consumers of the information, the readers, or is it managing it for the companies? And one thing you'll see with Glassdoor in particular, unlike some of the other review sites, is how they actually encourage the subject of reviews, in this case the companies, to solicit reviews from their workers, right? So on the other hand, Yelp is a site that actually has on its website, it tells restaurants and other local businesses, do not.
Right. Discourage that, because it's so ripe for manipulation. It's so ripe for, if your boss asks you to rate something on a website, I don't care if it's anonymous or not, I'm probably going to give it 5 stars until I leave that company, because why would I leave myself open to anyone discovering possibly that I wouldn't have rated them highly? This is a great conversation. We're going to return to it in just 1 minute. Rolf Winkler with The Wall Street Journal and Lori Shreve Blake with the USC Career Center. Back after this quick news update from Hedy Lynn Hurdies. It's Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Libby Denkman in for Larry Mantle. We're talking about a Wall Street Journal investigative report revealing that Glassdoor, the company review site where workers can say what it's like to work somewhere and kind of give other folks information about whether they should go ahead and work there too, Glassdoor can be manipulated. And this Wall Street Journal report found suspicious spikes in the reviews, especially around the time when the rankings of the best companies to work for would come out. And the report for the Wall Street Journal found that this was because oftentimes bosses would encourage their employees to review, or it would be rewarded in some way by the company. That investigation was by Rolf Winkler, a technology investigative reporter for the Wall Street Journal, who joins me now. And also in the studio right now is Lori Shreve Blake with the USC Career Center. I'm taking your calls on situations where you went into a job thinking it was one thing and then had a very rude awakening. And if you want to weigh in on that, it's 866-893-5722. And Edward in Monterey Park has a story. Edward, what happened with you?
Hi there. Thank you for having me.
Thanks for being here. What's your story?
So I'm a college student. And a big issue with college students is to have a job with flexible hours.
Sure.
So I heavily relied on Glassdoor because I've heard from other fellow college students that, you know, it was a good place to, you know, get reviews, get more information about potential jobs in the area. I ended up applying to a job through Glassdoor, getting the job, and then about two weeks to about a month into the actual job training, I realized that based off of the reviews that I saw on the Glassdoor website, that it was a completely different environment than what the reviews had been saying.
So it had very good reviews, I'm assuming, on Glassdoor. And when you got in the door, it turned out not to be the case?
Exactly. One of the things that made me apply for the job was the fact that the continuous mention of flexible hours and then decent pay was continuously mentioned in all of the recent reviews, which was the main pull factor that I was looking at.
Mm. And so did you end up having to leave that job, Edward, or did you have to go look for another one?
I did, because they were very, very strict on the amount of hours that they were giving me. They were not working with my schedule at all.
Yeah. So you, in terms of your review for Glassdoor, the review website, not a fan at this point because it steered you wrong.
No, I've actually told other people who said that they're going to use Glassdoor to stay away from it, because I told them that the reviews just aren't accurate. They weren't, you know, at all accurate with what I had experienced.
Edward in Monterey Park, I really appreciate the call. And just quickly want to go to Grace in Culver City. Your experience looking for a job, and then once you got there, what happened?
In 2015, I went to work briefly for a small law firm. And in doing my research, I saw favorable reviews on Glassdoor. So when they offered me the position, I took it. And when I got there, within a week, I realized, oh my God, this is a mistake. It was a totally toxic environment where the staff was terrified of the attorney, who was the owner and, you know, the operator. And everybody was terrified of her. She was abusive physically and verbally.
Oh, my gosh. Physically abusive and verbally. So, I mean, you couldn't stay in that job, I'm assuming, Grace.
Throw things at you. Yeah. And she would just do what she, you know, whenever she felt like. It was so capricious, whatever her mood was of the day. So in the end of the day, I was fired. I did not, because I stood up to her for something she, you know, had accused me of, and which I couldn't possibly have done. So when I stood up to her, she fired me. And when I left, I put in a negative review to Glassdoor. And then later, about 6 months later, another former, you know, another colleague who worked there, who was also fired, and she contacted me and she said, did you see the ratings on Glassdoor about the firm? So I went and looked it up, and to my surprise, there was like a rebuttal on Glassdoor that somebody put in how wonderful the company was and how supportive the owner partner was.
So somebody trying to kind of cancel out your experience. Grace in Culver City, I do have a time crunch here, so I have to let you go, but I do very much appreciate the experience, and I want to get Rolf Winkler's take on those anecdotes from folks in our audience who experienced things that I think you dug up in your reporting as well, right?
Correct. So that sounds, Grace's story sounds very much like what we found at a company called Guaranteed Rate, which is a mortgage broker in Chicago. Last summer, they were getting some negative reviews. The rating for the CEO, his approval rating on Glassdoor, had fallen to 43%. The company was rated 2.6 out of 5 stars. And then around August, according to my sources, there was some concern. August, September, there was concern that this could hurt their recruiting. So the CEO asked his lieutenants, said, we need to recruit tenured employees who are going to go on there and put reviews out there. And sure enough, they had had something like 10, 20 reviews a month. Then in September and October, there were about 300, mostly 5-star, many from people who identified as managers on Glassdoor. And it worked. So his rating now was 43%. Now it's 83%.
I think about this, Rolf, because, you know, this can happen on Yelp and other websites and things that, you know, are just choices that people might make about a hotel or a restaurant. But this is your career. I mean, these are decisions that people are basing on this website and hoping that they're going to be, you know, safe and maybe moving to a new job at this company that gets good ratings. I mean, this is a big deal if people trust it and it's not trustworthy.
I think Lori's point, the first point that she made is absolutely correct, which is you can look at Glassdoor reviews if you want, maybe as a first pass as part of your due diligence, but that is probably it's certainly no substitute for finding a real person that works in the division of the company you want to go work for, who can tell you, yes, you're going to work for a person named this person, and this is the reality of working for that person.
Yeah. Lori Shreve-Blake joins me now, Senior Director at the USC Career Center. Your take on these calls and what folks should be doing to protect themselves.
Yes. Well, one thing, definitely, I think people need to be on LinkedIn. And for Grace, who called in and said there was a small law firm, had she gone onto LinkedIn and maybe even put in that law firm's name, she might have found former employees that work for that small firm, and she could have had an informational interview to talk to them. But the other thing is, people, I think the information you glean is the most accurate information. And in an interview, a lot of times people think it's a monologue. I have to just talk till I'm blue in the face to get the job. But really, it's a dialogue. And so what I tell candidates is arrive 15 minutes before the interview, sit there and watch people walking by, employees. Are they upset? Is there yelling? Are books being thrown at people? I mean, are there any telltale signs that you can glean? And even in the interview, you want to try to read, you know, what's going on. So I think talking to former and current employees, getting their take on it, drilling down if it's a big behemoth organization to that specific department, because the culture at a big organization, you're going to have 200 different cultures and experiences. And then also, as I said, using LinkedIn, looking at professional associations and alma maters and different groups where you can find former or current employees to talk to. And then in addition to Glassdoor, there's some other resources that are out there. We use at uscvault.com, which is great for getting the uppers and downers of a company. So this are the uppers are this and the downers are that. There's Indeed, Career Bliss, Fairy God Boss, The Muse, and Quora. So there's other resources out there. But at the end of the day, you're going to be spending a third of your life doing this job and
right.
career. It's not like going to a restaurant, like
or
you said,
more,
Libby.
Depending on your hours.
Exactly.
I mean,
you're going to spend
put in more than that.
Even more than a third of your life doing this.
Sure.
And so you need to make sure this is the right culture and the right, you know, the right environment and the right department. And so I used to think networking was just to get into the job. But years ago, somebody taught me, they said, no, actually, this department is a good department to work for. So you need to get your what I call your intel.
Yeah.
On that organization.
Christina in Long Beach.
Yes.
Yeah, absolutely. That's Lori Shreve-Blake with the USC Career Center. Christina in Long Beach is on the line. And Christina, you have seen this issue of Glassdoor manipulation up close?
I certainly have. I worked for a smaller startup company run by younger business owners, younger entrepreneurs, who they almost lived in and breathed by the sentiment of the Glassdoor reviews they received. If there was a negative review, the owner would
would be almost upset. It would affect his mood, and he would request that employees write reviews that were more positive to almost counteract the negative reviews that were posted to the site.
So he would like log in during the day and look at the review, and then that would impact how he treated employees?
Not directly, but you could just tell that he was unhappy by it. And instead of accepting the criticism and taking steps to make positive changes, he would just immediately go on the defense and try and get the rest of the company to kind of come with him and say, hey, you know, let's write more positive stuff about the company on Glassdoor to improve our image, basically.
Wow. Christina in Long Beach, thanks for that experience. And this is a whole new world, Rolf Winkler with The Wall Street Journal. I had no idea this was something that, you know, companies and bosses were so keyed in on. But your reporting has really revealed this whole way that, you know, image can be manipulated online in a unique way. And I thank you so much for sharing it today on Air Talk.
Thanks for having me.
And Lori Shreve-Blake was with me as well, senior director at the USC Career Center. And if you want to follow her on Twitter, by the way, Lori Shreve-Blake is her handle. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you, Libby.
I'm Libby Dankman, in for Larry Mantle today. After a very short break, we're going to get to a unique story about the history of Camp Pendleton near San Diego and race relations on that Marine base. I'll be right back after this. It's Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Libby Dankman, sitting in for Larry Mantle. And my next guest has explored a pretty extraordinary story about white supremacy and the military. It's from a chapter in Southern California history I think a lot of people may have forgotten. The story looks at a time when racial tensions were extremely high at Camp Pendleton, the Marine Corps base north of San Diego, and its subjects are a group of African-American Marines who tried to fight back against white supremacist activity on the base, but they wound up making a mistake that really landed them in a lot of legal trouble. And my guest is Steve Walsh, military reporter for NPR member station KPBS in San Diego. And his new podcast, where he explores this story, is called Free the Pendleton 14. And Steve is also my colleague on the American Homefront Project reporting collaborative. Hi, Steve. Thanks so much for being on the show.
Hi, Libby. It's really good to talk to you.
Yeah, great to hear your voice. You know, first off, Steve, can you kind of describe the setting for this story and what the racial politics were at the time on a base like Camp Pendleton?
So this is 1976 when this incident happened here. So imagine this is just after the Vietnam War has wrapped up. And a group of African-American Marines were experiencing not just white supremacy, but the Ku Klux Klan. Other Marines were openly involved in the Ku Klux Klan on Camp Pendleton. You know, it's a very tumultuous time for the Marine Corps. The Marines were heavily involved in Vietnam and are often described as a broken force at this point. There's a lot of turmoil going on in this base. In the middle of it, these African-American Marines are experiencing open racism and the Ku Klux Klan. They decide on one evening in 1976 in November to take action to attack what they thought was a Klan meeting going on just in the same barracks complex where they lived. They attacked a group of Marines. Turned out that the Klan meeting was happening next door. They got the wrong room. Initially, the Marine Corps really tries heavily to cover this up. And then when it comes out that, yes, the Klan was operating at this Marine base in Southern California, it becomes national news. All the major networks at the time come to San Diego to cover the trial. And eventually it draws David Duke, who comes in to defend the rights of the Klansmen Marines.
Yeah, of course he has to get involved in some way. Just really quickly, Steve, I wanted to ask. So just to be clear, in the 1970s, you know, you were able to join and display white supremacist affiliation? I mean, because that's definitely not legal. That's not okay for military members anymore.
I can hear the surprise in your voice. That's what surprised me about this story. I did not think so. And it's very unclear whether or not they were actually allowed to be openly a part of the Klan. It's not officially banned until 1986, when the Secretary of Defense rules that you cannot be a part of any of these white supremacist organizations. But it certainly was not well known up until that point. And the Marine Corps tried to really pretend that they knew nothing about this happening, though it becomes very clear that they knew full well that the Klan was there on Camp Pendleton.
Yeah. Steve Walsh with KPBS is on the line with me. His new podcast is called Free the Pendleton 14, where he examines this incredible chapter in Southern California history. And as Steve was just saying, a group of African-American Marines think that they're going to break up a Ku Klux Klan meeting. And they got the room next door to this Klan meeting. And Steve, you were saying, so there was actually a group of white supremacists there, very near where they were attempting to break up, but they simply got the wrong room.
Right. And it comes out eventually at trial that there was a list of 16 Klansmen found in the barracks room next door. So they found weapons and everything. In fact, if they had gotten the right room, it's very likely that their people could have been killed. There would have been an armed clash at that point with the Klan.
And what happened to these young, mostly Marines, these African-American Marines, and what happened to the Ku Klux Klan members who were eventually discovered on campus? What goes forward from there?
Well, the Marines goes from covering it up to try to quickly remove the Klansmen Marines. What happens is this becomes this major sort of cause celeb. Again, David Duke shows up. It's amazing when you look back through the record how seriously David Duke is taken at that time. People give him whole articles in the San Diego Union. He's interviewed on national television, and he quickly starts playing the victim and they're saying that, you know, these Klansmen are the real victim here. And it's amazing to hear so many of the things that you're hearing now coming out of the alt-right, coming out of the mouths of actual Klansmen back in 1976.
Yeah, because when I first heard about this podcast that you're hosting, Free the Pendleton 14, you mentioned, you know, even today, this violence in Charlottesville involved at least one member, active duty member of the military. And so what you're saying is this is very relevant to keep an eye on this issue of white supremacy and its prevalence in our culture and in the military as well.
The parallels are pretty striking. We definitely know that these attitudes don't go away. They seem to pop up and then they go underground. They pop up and they go underground. And it feels like we're in an era where it's really beginning to pop up again. We've seen the military make changes over the decades. And the one Marine that was eventually discovered marching with the neo-Nazis, he was eventually discharged from the Marine Corps. Mm. But we know that there is still a real presence of these white supremacist groups in the military even today.
Yeah, Steve Walsh with KPBS. Go check out his podcast on iTunes or wherever you get your podcast because it's an incredible story. Free the Pendleton 14. And Steve tweets at Steve Walsh if you want to follow him. Thanks again, Steve.
Thanks, Libby. Appreciate it.
It's Libby Denkman in for Larry Mantle today on Air Talk. Thanks so much for listening. And Larry will be back tomorrow.